Tonight on Arena, Resistance, Joan of Arc and The Day After I'm Gone are the movies up for review, and rapper JLOL on the political power of music. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Thursday night means movie night here in Arena as usual. Donald Clark and Ruth Barton have been casting their eyes over the pick of this week's digital releases. Bruno Dumont revisits the iconic story of Joan of Arc. Nimrod Eldar brings us The Day After I'm Gone, a father-daughter story. But before all of that, we'll start with Resistance, which is about Marcel Marceau's time in the French Resistance, starring Jesse Eisenberg as the great mime artist, long before he was a great mime artist, Marcel Marceau. Who knew about this? Because I've been asking around people, Ruth Barton, asking people today, did you know this backstory of Marcel Marceau? It's a fascinating backstory.
No, I didn't have a clue. And I was completely fascinated by this because I've always, you know, Marcel Marceau is more of an image in my mind. I didn't know anything of his story. And boy, is it an amazing story. I mean, the Resistance gives you the, you know, what it's about. But what I didn't know and now do know is that Marcel Marceau, who was at the time Marcel Mengele, son of a Jewish family, his father was a kosher butcher, was an aspiring actor, did Charlie Chaplin impressions, didn't care much about life until the war starts and his cousin gets him involved, long story short, in the Resistance. And he becomes involved reluctantly at first and then absolutely passionately with this group of Jewish kids who are escaping across Europe from the Nazis. And he strikes up this relationship with them and he entertains them. He takes their mind off their troubles. He leads them, basically, sort of Pied Piper-like through France. At the same time, he turns out to be also an ace forger. So he's able to forge passports for them and, apparently, you know, in an hour, no problem. And he's also incredibly brave. And he basically was responsible for saving the lives of many, you know, many hundreds of Jewish children. I didn't have a clue.
Donald Clark, are you with Ruth and I on this one? Were you aware of this backstory to Marcel Marceau?
I was not. I mean, I think somewhere in the back of my mind, I was aware that he was involved with the Resistance, but there are kind of, you know, there's a whole spectrum of involvement with Resistance you can have. I mean, he was really involved with the Resistance. As Ruth has explained, he was, he and his colleagues were responsible for allowing thousands of young Jewish children to escape with the assistance of the Boy Scouts and so forth. And also, the thing we haven't mentioned is, which is almost as interesting, if not quite as dramatic, is he was liaison to General Patton after the liberation of France, because he spoke very decent English and very decent German, which is a relationship that could forge a film all on its own, I would have thought. We don't get much of that here. We get a kind of framing sequence where you see Ed Harris as General Patton at the beginning and then at the end. There's a hell of a film in that story. This is not quite that film. This is not quite the film that we would have hoped for. It's pretty decent, but it does lean towards the sentimental a bit. Does lean towards a bit towards the sensational. The villains do cackle a bit loudly. There's a Klaus Barbie, the notorious Nazi, appears in this, and he is presented a little bit like a Bond villain, which is, I guess, a complete circle you get. The Bond villains were somewhat influenced by representations of the Nazis during the war. As well, at the heart of it is Jesse Eisenberg's performance, which is interesting because I felt in the opening 20 minutes when you get him a sort of superhero origin story, kind of the origins of the Marcel Marceau character developing, I sort of worried because I thought, oh, he can't really do this. I mean, with the best will in the world, I mean, maybe if there's a larger budget film, big studio film, they would have been able to send Jesse Eisenberg somewhere where he could learn to be a top quality mime. But he's not really even up to kind of Grafton Street standards, not to mention up to the standards of Marceau. But actually, that doesn't really matter very much because, in fact, there's an opening section and a performance at the end, but really kind of, you know, 75% of the film is this story about a young man, a Jewish man, finding himself through his work with the Resistance. And that he does very well. And I quite like this notion that you have the the sort of core Jesse Eisenberg character, which is kind of a chamele in the school of Woody Allen, becoming a man through this work. And I think that works quite nicely. And he does that chamele very well. In this case, a chamele who actually finds himself and becomes a hero.
Yeah, and falls in love, which is a big part of the story as well, with one of the other young women in the resistance movement, Ruth, Emma, played by Clémence Poésy.
Yeah, Emma, and he also has a brief relationship with her sister as well. And she, he has that relationship, and that's, part of the tension builds up because she's the woman in peril in the story. So it is, I find this a sort of rather bizarre mixture of kind of mainstream Hollywood retelling of history and with those sort of Hollywood characters, which is the woman in peril and the love interest. And then a very kind of European vibe to the film as well, brought in by the casting of people like Clémence Poésy, who of course all have to speak in English with foreign accents, as does Eisenberg have to speak English with foreign accents, with a foreign accent. And in fact, I'm sort of less keen on him than Donald is, because I found it disruptive having a big Hollywood star in what seemed to be a European story.
Yeah, and certainly in the beginning, I thought, is this Marcel Marceau, or is it just somebody who wants to be like Marcel Marceau? But that's a different strand in the story. Let's listen to a clip that features both Eisenberg and Clémence Poésy, in fact, as the characters of Emma and Marcel, respectively. Now, Emma she's just coming back from an incredible interrogation sequence that we see happening, very frightening, I thought, at any rate, interrogation sequence. So they're now Emma and Marcel underneath the bridge, and they're getting to the core argument of the film here, which is it, can the resistance do anything, in fact?
What can we truly accomplish?
I can fight back. We found homes for the children, safe places.
No place is safe for them as long as they're in a country that's occupied by Nazis. And the little fighting that we can do...
We can slow them down and we can make it impossible for them in France.
What is it the Nazis want?
What?
They don't care about Klaus Barbie, or a bunch of Gestapo slaves that we may kill, if we are lucky.
No, you're right. They care about killing us like they killed her.
So what's the best way to resist? It's not to kill them. They are ready to die. If you want to resist, we have to make sure more Jews survive.
And there we go, Clémence Poésy and Jesse Eisenberg as Emma and Marcel from the film Resistance. And Donald, I was just asking Ruth in studio here as we were listening to that clip, Clémence Poésy is French herself, so the broken English, or not the accented English, sounds okay in her mouth, but in Eisenberg and some of the other characters, it always bothers me.
It's very old-fashioned, isn't it? It is something that was kind of commonplace up until the 70s and 80s, and people really got out of the habit of doing that. I guess maybe they were thinking, because he's surrounded by people who have accents, that he should do the accent for consistency. Mm. But that notion of when you're playing a German in a film that is delivered in English, who talks like this, is awfully old fashioned. And there's an awful lot you've got to buy here. I mean, ultimately, I got along with it, but there's an awful lot you have to let go here. I mean, the opening story, for a start, is such a cliche. I mean, it's the jazz singer, essentially, or indeed Krusty the Clown's story in The Simpsons. The Jewish entertainer who has the father who doesn't want him to become an entertainer, or wants him to go off and do something more responsible. You've got that going on. The scenes where he alleviates the children's tension and their fear with through performance is a little bit close to Life is Beautiful, which is a film which has all kinds of problems with it. But ultimately, I think it has enough kind of old school energy behind it that doesn't matter, and I found myself at the end genuinely kind of excited and kind of driven along by it, as I would if I were watching a classic kind of like box office entertainment of the 1970s playing on a bank holiday weekend. I think it works pretty well in that regard. And a more serious one, I think actually I'm glad you played that clip, because there are interesting conversations in here about the nature of the resistance, and that was an interesting conversation. So it gets to the point about what's more significant, acts of revenge, violence against Nazis, or actually doing something to help those who would who are now or maybe in the future victims.
Yes, and let me come to Ruth on another aspect. You touched there, Donald, on, you know, the kind of slightly Bond villain nature of the Klaus Barbie character as played by Matthias Schweighofer, if that's how I say his name correctly. But I did find, and I don't know, did you, Ruth, some of those interrogation sequences, there are sequences in a swimming pool in Strasbourg where people are just left standing there. Shots come, you know, randomly out of nowhere. The person beside you falls dead. I mean, frightened the living daylights out of me.
There was some really good, I totally agree, Don. There's some really good encounters in this. And the sequence, the hotel is called Hotel Terminus, which is, you know, bad enough.
Yeah.
And it is the terminus for the people who go in there. And, there is a really creepy torture sequence, the two women. And then there's also, I think, I really thought the sequence on the train where he's smuggling the children out and they all are singing Ave Maria to show that, you know, so to be convincingly Gentile, if you like. And, Klaus Barbie Schweighofer comes onto the train and also the woman he's tortured is, you know, hiding in the toilet. Will she be revealed? Mm. And that was really well done and really tense. But then there was all this kind of real pulpy stuff around it.
Yeah. It needed a little bit of an edit. Maybe that would have sorted out the pulpy stuff. Overall, Jonathan Jakubowicz, I think, is the director here. Overall, did it work for you, Donald? Would you allow it in terms of its maybe pulpy bits and overlong exposition?
Yes. I mean, as I said earlier on, I will permit the rather obvious story points and the rather clumsy framing. So I think it does rattle along quite effectively and does make some serious arguments about the pressures that the resistance was put under, and also explains to us a story that we might not know and is genuinely interesting, as we said at the start.
Yeah, and we have stars, Donald, briefly.
I'm giving it a 3.
You're giving it a 3. Overall, what did you think, Ruth, and stars?
3, very uneven, but, you know, it would pass the time. And as Donald says, you learn something, and that's always good.
Good for the even bits. Yeah. All right.
Faintly educational.
Right. Let's move on then to Bruno Dumont's version of Joan of Arc. A French auteur. Certainly he is a filmmaker, Donald, that the word auteur is perfectly suitable for.
Oh, yeah.
it's not the first time that he's tackled the Joan of Arc subject either, is it?
No. You could, if you're being facetious, describe this as sort of a franchise. That it's the hardcore art house franchise version of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. In that a few years ago... he made a film called The Childhood of Joan of Arc, starring the same actress, Lisa Laplace-Prudhomme, this is a film with all kinds of eccentricities to it, but that was even more eccentric. It told the tale that suggests in the title of The Childhood of Joan of Arc to a kind of pounding heavy metal beat that was deafening. Mm. And he's taken this, always been an eccentric director who continually moves in directions that you don't expect, and he's done a sort of sequel to that, but in fact in an entirely different style. So it's hard to describe it really as being a formal sequel. But that's kind of how he's worked. Mm. He's had a strange career. I mean, he started off doing really brutal films like Satan, Humanité, 29 Palms a decade or so ago, twice winner of the Grand Prix at Cannes. In the last few years, he's skewed to a bizarre surreal comedy with films like Slack Bay and the television series Petit Cancan. So you feel like he feels an obligation to blindside us at every turn, not just with the start of the film, but throughout a film and the strange turns it takes. This is also sort of a musical, not to the extent The Childhood of Joan of Arc is, but there are a few songs, electronic songs, large electronic songs, some on piano by French legend Christophe, spaced throughout the running time. And sometimes they have a sacred quality, sometimes they're playful. And that kind of adds to the sense that of the director doing everything possible to alienate us and put us in a position that we don't know quite where we are.
Yeah, so and we're dealing with, for the most part here, amateur actors, Ruth. Is how vital is that to the style that Dumont is giving us in this film? And I'm asking in the process of that to describe that style.
Yeah, this is so eccentric. I mean, it starts off and I'm thinking sort of, oh, Monty Python, this is quite funny, because these amateur actors gather on a beach and one by one they sort of join the other. And there's that thing that amateur actors have, which is they don't come quickly in after the other. When one finishes a sentence, there's a gap and then the other one picks it up. So you have that kind of the sort of awkward silences.
Good editors can fix that up.
Yeah, indeed, but he's not. This isn't what Dumont's after. So they stand around in this sort of very awkward manner, very evidently delivering lines. Then you have this child who was only 10 when the film was made, who's playing Joan of Arc, Lise Le Plat Prudhomme. And she has to, you know, sort of interact with them, but she also has to have ecstatic moments where she looks at the sky. And then, you know, you bring on Christoph's synth pop music while she stands looking ecstatically at the sky. So it is just, I mean, it is so bizarre. It's so alienating. Not for one moment could you lose yourself in this film.
Well, let's have a listen to Christoph, what he does here. Now, up until this point, we're very much in the period, in the 15th century?
15th century.
Yeah, 15th century that we're in. We're there. The costumes are of that period. There's a drum beating in the background, which could be a battle drum from a battlefield. So you're stuck.
It really annoyed me, that drum.
Yeah. It went on for a long time. But then it suddenly stops. Joan of Arc, as played by this young Lise Le Plat Prudhomme, stands absolutely still for the 3 minutes and 19 seconds. I won't play all of it, of this track. And after the drum fades off into the background, suddenly this starts. There we go. That's just the opening section there of that track by Christoph from Joan of Arc, the Bruno de Monte new realization of the story of the great French hero of Joan of Arc. I love the track, but okay, what was, do you think Dumont was getting at, looking for us to do there, Donald? Because it struck me, I really looked at the translation of the subtext here, but all I was looking at on screen was this absolutely static framed picture of the young character, of the young Lise Le Plat Prudhomme as Joan.
Well, I think in all musicals, that whenever the song kicks in, there's a notion of epiphany, isn't there? That this is the point at which they're lifted outside of the real world, outside of the everyday world, and we get at the higher notions, the higher ambitions that characters have within a film. And in this case, those higher notions obviously are holy ambitions. It's her connection with the voices in the sky who are telling her what to do. And I think we're obviously, given that this is far from being a formal didactic film, we're left to have to draw our own conclusions about where those voices come from. But I think, I mean, I would stress, I think in the opening section of this film, I think in the middle section where you have the theological conversations, it becomes enormously dry. And I think you have to work very hard to make yourself enjoy it at that point. But the opening section is genuinely playful. Not least towards the end, when you have this battle sequence which takes place with, if I may quote Michael Curtis via David Niven, dancing horses. You have these horses who kind of like prance around to this military beat, first from below and then from above. I think it's fabulous. And that's the kind of thing you sort of want more of. But you have to, I think, make allowances for anybody in France approaching this story. They have to find something to do. As you're aware throughout this film, and any film on this subject, that French are in a conversation with an overwhelming cinematic and historical heritage. I mean, few countries really have an emblematic figure like this in their past, a hero martyred by the country she saved. And I admire his attempts to shrug off all that and concentrate on the mechanics of the trial and on the theology, and more successfully, as I say, on these moments of epiphany, these strange, weird moments where he plays a filmmaking technique. And there's more than that you've got to shrug off, because the cinematic legacy as well. I mean, Joan of Arc has been Ingmar Bergman, Ingrid Bergman, Gene Seberg, Mila Jovovich, and most overpoweringly, she was Marie Falconetti in one of the most admired films in cinema history, Dreyer's The Passion of Joan Arc. So I think he can be forgiven for making a major swerve with the last film, The Childhood, and a significant deviation from on the norm with this film. Yeah, you've got to do something.
What that the horse, the dressage, essentially, I thought, you know, this wouldn't have been out of place in a military tattoo. What we see, and pretty bloodless battle. I think the grimace on your face is suggesting great was not the word that was about to pop out of your mouth, Ruth Barton.
Well, I actually enjoyed that kind of dressage sequence. I was with the film pretty much at that point. It was really the really extended sequence in the cathedral, which is absolutely beautiful. And again, it's visually really impactful because she's this tiny, I mean, the child is a tiny child as well. And you have this vast cathedral and have these very sort of menacing inquisitors. But oh boy, I just got really bored in that section. I couldn't engage with the kind of ideas enough.
But you mentioned the child there. How good a casting decision was that? Like, she's so young. I don't know what age she is, but she's a very young Joan of Arc. She was 10.
She was 10 when they filmed it. The actress was 10 when they filmed it. She's 12
now. Which is even younger than Joan of Arc.
Oh, yeah, she was actually, you know, acting up an age bracket, if you like, because she was in the first one as a very small child. I actually thought that was inspirational, because she's got this very fierce child face, and she puts on a scowl, and she scowls at everybody, and she's apparently capable of standing still and scowling for long periods of time.
Well, yeah,
which is required of her.
2 hours and 20 minutes.
Yes, I was going to say, you need a long period of time to watch it as well, that's for sure. We should mention, of course, that Christophe, the French musician, he died of COVID-19. During the pandemic, so, you know, sad aspect that to the film as well. Did it work overall for you, Donald, and stars out of five? I'm sure Bruno Dumont doesn't even worry about stars.
Extremely vulgar, I'm sure he'd say. I think it's sufficiently odd and intermittently brilliant amongst the boredom for me to be indulgently give it 4, though I'm sure I suspect Ruth will bristle at that.
Well, are you going to indulge or not indulge, Ruth?
As you say, it just seems so kind of bourgeois to give it stars.
Exactly. Sorry, you know, to be so common.
I hesitate to fall into the trap, but I was actually, you know, I put 3 out of 5 on my notes, then I put a question mark after it because I'm an academic, so I have to, you know, I have maybe a couple of footnotes too.
3 stars with a couple of footnotes from you, and 4 then from Donald. Finally then, let's move on to, there was a reason. Curzon Home Cinema from tomorrow for Joan of Arc, and general digital release, by the way, for Resistance, which we spoke about earlier. Finally then, on to The Day After I'm Gone, debut feature from the Israeli filmmaker Nimrod Eldar. Ostensibly a father-daughter relationship story, but given the setting, the political can't be too far away, Ruth.
Yeah, well, it's an Israeli film. It's set in Israel, and it starts off in the city where the central character Yoram, who's played by Menashe Noy, he's a vet at a safari park, and so it's sort of so far so ordinary. He's very worried about his 17-year-old daughter who's gone missing. We learn very quickly that his wife, her mother, died recently, and he's worried about her mental health. And sure enough, there's a suicide attempt. I'm not writing that off, but that's actually not, you know, not the question you were asking me, because they then go basically on a road trip to his late wife's family, her mother's family, who are in the occupied territories. They're in settlements near the Dead Sea, and so the film takes us very quickly. You know, in part, it's the father-daughter relationship story, and the title of the film, The Day After I'm Gone, is following a question she asks him: what would happen the day after I die? You know, what would happen if I died? But the film then takes us off into this very, you know, literally political territory, and by way of the vandalization of a monument that the small village that the family are in, they had put up to a member of the village who'd been killed in the encounters, and it's been vandalized, and his brother-in-law, who's quite sort of aggressive and punchy, says, well, of course, it was those Arabs who came along. And he said, why would they? And he said, oh, they're Arabs, that's what they do. And so you're suddenly plunged into a very kind of political environment, which the film sort of never quite lays its cards on the table as to why it's doing that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, Don, because when it moved from the veterinary sequence at the beginning with big animals, a big cat, it was a leopard, I think, that was carried into the operating table, and then suddenly we were in this domestic drama with a father-daughter relationship at play, I thought, oh, right, well, what analogies have been drawn here? But then that shift into the political towards the end, I was slightly uncomfortable and bemused by it.
I didn't think it was forced upon us. I mean, I did have some reservations about the fact that, coming from where we come from, if you look at a film, an Israeli film, which someone visits a relative in the occupied territories, we already kind of, our hackles rise slightly, such are the complexities and the traumas of that region. And it maybe feels a little bit obvious to have him act out, to have him be an aggressive player, not just in terms of his relationships to his Arab neighbours, but also in terms of relationship to his family. So whereas most of the people in the family are open to her problems and want her to discuss her problems, and they say the right things, like, nobody will blame you, nobody will, you know. He's in the kind of, she just needs a good shake category.
Yeah.
That he describes her as what it is, something to the effect of, like, you know, you're a spoiled child or whatever. That felt a little bit obvious. It's like, you know, it's always better to kind of play with our expectations and perhaps have a character who's in that position being a little kinder than he turned out to be. But that seemed to me to be largely in the background. The film seemed to me ostensibly about this very, very subtle, I thought, exploration of a relationship in which the father and the daughter don't communicate. They're unable to communicate. Perhaps they were able to communicate better before the mother died, but now in that situation where they're both traumatized in different ways and they can't get through to one another. And I really like the way in which that sort of changes over the space of a relatively short film, but not so much that you drift into sentimentality. There's no great kind of revelation. There's no sense that, oh, they're over it now and everything will be fine. There are just subtle shifts, particularly when they're at this day. And I think I would recommend it more than anything else because of the way in which this debut director, Nimrod Eltar, expresses that alienation through cinematic language. In particular, you have this interesting thing that for the first 20 minutes, maybe 20 minutes, I would say, of the film, you don't really see the girl. I mean, she's in the flat with him, but she sort of flits past quickly and she's outside the frame. Then there's this scene whenever her suicide attempt is discovered, and that's all shot from a static camera about a room's length away from her bedroom, and all you can see are people kind of flitting backwards and forwards through the door frame. And then when you finally get a two-shot of them, interestingly, he is in focus and she's not. And all that is getting at the sense that we're seeing it from his perspective.
Yes.
He's the protagonist and he is not seeing her. He's not connecting with her. And as the film goes on, the camera does open up more to her and we see her.
So he's telling his story.
And that seems to me very clever and subtle. Surprised me.
And in terms of a debut feature, then, you were excited about stars from you, Donald?
Oh, four. I thought it was very impressive.
All right, okay. And overall then, Ruth, as the film went on, did you follow the same type of journey as Donald has described there, where the relationship opened out to you? Did it work?
Yeah, no, I mean, I thought the relationship was interesting, but I was very distracted by what seemed to me an attempt at a political parable. Particularly, there's a sequence when the family-in-law, if you like, gather around the table, and the two young girls have to perform this song praising Israel. Which, was that ironic or was it not? So I was distracted by that. And if it had only been the father-daughter story, I think it would have been a stronger film. So it was three out of five for me.
Three out of five from Ruth. That's Ruth Barton and Donald Clark. By the way, Day After I'm Gone is available on Mubi, and the other two films, Joan of Arc on Curzon Home Cinema from tomorrow, and Resistance on general digital release. Dublin rapper JLOL was in studio with us exactly 1 year ago for a session in Studio 8. His new single will be released tomorrow, Friday, June the 19th, with a debut album due to follow in December. I'll speak with JLOL shortly about how the last year has been for him. But first of all, let's listen to the new single, which will give us a real flavour of the album to come. This is a track called Jewels. Yeah.
Jewels, new single from JLOL, and that will be, I presume, on the album that we're going to get in December. JLOL, Jay joining me on the line now. Jewels, a word that has lots of value inherent or suggested within it, Jay, but I'm just picking up on one of the lyrics towards the end of the song there. What you want, I got different jewels. You're talking about maybe a different type of value that we should be looking at. Is that what the song's about?
Yeah, absolutely. The song is about, it's about understanding that we are all inherently valuable, but our value may just manifest itself in different realms. You know what I mean? So it may not always be physical. It may be something you're really good at, you know, something that makes you valuable. You know, wherever your value manifests, it's very important to note that whatever you do is what makes you special at that and as a human,
And in fact, I think you can probably thank your Jamaican grandmother for that type of sentiment existing within you at all. Your parents are Jamaican and Nigerian, of Jamaican and Nigerian descent, but that Jamaican grandmother, she taught you, I think you've given a quote, in a world that wants to force you down a particular path, she taught you how to be yourself. What did she teach you? What did she say that made that so possible to you?
Oh, I've learned so much from my grandmother. It's like I grew up with her, both my grandparents, actually. So it's just being around, you know, being around people who had lived so much life and just experienced so much. You know, my grandmother, she was very prideful. Well, she is very prideful. And she's such a lively character. And every time she walks in the room, everyone just, like, she lightens up the room, you know what I mean? So she just taught me it's important to be yourself. It's important to not take on too much criticism, and a place where there's so much negativity, to always try and be that positive spark, you know, be that injection of positivity as much as you can, of course.
And you're working towards the album. What state is that at, Jay? Because I'm remembering when you were in with us and you had Conor King was in on bass, Sambo Drums was on drums, Stephen McCann was on guitar. So has the album still been made with the lads involved, or have you done most of it by yourself?
No, the album, I'm happy to say, is completely wrapped up. We're currently in release mode right now. The production on the album was done, executively produced by Chris Cabs, written and composed by myself, written and performed as well. So it's been, and the lads who performed with me, they're part of my band as well. I'm very happy to have such a strong team. And, you know, like I said, again, you know, their value manifests in different realms, because they may not be involved in the production side, but when it's time to perform, I know exactly who to go to. And I know that's where they shine completely.
So most of that communal work, or that collaborative work, then had been done before lockdown and all of that. You were at a different point when you were isolated.
Yeah, most of it was done. I'd say it was wrapped up around early this year. You know what I mean? Around January. That's when I was finally ready to say, yeah, the album is done, signed, sealed, just waiting to be delivered.
I was. Thinking today as well, when I was speaking to you tonight, Jay, about your 2007 track, Cold in the Summer, and that was, what are we, 3 years back at this stage, really? And 2017, I beg your pardon, did I say it? I think I said 2017 was when you did it, Cold in the Summer. And you really were looking at the international scene, and you were looking at racial injustice back then. Have things changed anything? Is that still a very important aspect of the new album, of the songs on the new album?
It is definitely a very important part of not just the album, but also what I represent as an artist and also as a human. I feel like things have changed, but progress isn't always fast. You know what I mean? In fact, in some cases, it takes a lot of small steps to finally get to the big leap. So I guess ultimately what we've seen over the past few weeks in terms of the racial inequality and racial injustice is a lot more people being aware of what's actually going on, you know, but we've been in the awareness stage for so long. And I think now we're at the height of the awareness stage, where it's time for people to become restless in their inactivity. So everyone is thinking now, what can we do to mobilize against this problem, not just to be aware of it?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the question I want to ask you. What can we do to mobilise against the problem? And I mean here a kind of cross-community type of support for what you're talking about. And essentially we're talking about Black Lives Matter when we talk about the last couple of weeks, certainly. Right across the community, what is the way to support people who want to fight against racial inequalities? What's the right support to give?
You know, it's ironic that I said we've been in the awareness stage too long, because I do believe that the right cross-community support that we can get from everyone is that awareness, and everyone just being able to have that conversation and educate themselves on issues on minority issues and take on perspectives from minorities as well. Because from a place of privilege, it's not always easy to recognize your own privilege and others, you know, lack thereof. So I think what we need to do is we need to re-educate ourselves, because it's not just an issue of Black lives. That is what's going on. But around the world, there's so much injustice. And I think discrimination is so deep rooted in humanity, like in just the world today, that we need to actively educate ourselves against it. I don't even know if that's fully possible, but we can tackle one issue at a time.
You have a degree in politics, in fact, Jay, from UCD. Obviously, as you're describing it to me there, there's a very strong set of political bones in your body, and it comes out in your music. Is there another side to that political activism for you? You know, could you see yourself going a more direct route in the political scenario?
You know, I've always been very interested in politics, but I don't know. As of right now, I don't see myself pursuing a career in it, because I'm very focused on my music. But I do believe that you don't actually have to be directly involved in politics to make an impact or make a change. Like, I was looking at what's happened in the UK recently with Marcus Rashford, Manchester United footballer, and just the change he's made there from being a footballer, and the voice, how he's been able to use his platform for such a positive impact. So that's the kind of impact I want to have, as opposed to you know, going doing the rounds around local councils and then, you know, the Dáil and all of that. But yeah, I definitely use my platform.
Yeah, use your music in that respect, and use it as a platform to say what you want to say politically. 2019, great year for your two EPs. You were at lots of festivals, in fact, when there were festivals back in 2019, Body and Soul, Longitude, Electric. Yeah, and you were at a jazz festival in Holland as well. Are you missing all of that? How are you managing with lockdown?
Oh, Lord, I am missing it. I can't tell you a lie. I'm missing it a lot. It's burning inside of me. So the next time I'm going to perform, it's going to be the best performance that I've ever done. Yeah. I'm really going to leave everything on the stage. I'm really looking forward to it. You know, I think there was so much momentum coming from last year with the festivals and the headline shows and everything. With the album coming as well, you know, it's giving myself and my team a chance to just go back to the drawing board and think, well, what can we do on this side of things as well when everything goes back somewhat normal?
Did you watch it, in the words of Norm, and picking up on Normal, did you watch Normal People, and how excited were you when you knew that your music was going to be used within it?
Oh, no, I was very excited. Reason being, Oh Lord is a track that I actually made 2 years ago with my friend, good collaborator, Aaron Unknown. So it was very exciting to see that 2 years on, it could still be given a chance to make that kind of cultural impact on a show that is very culturally impactful itself, you know. So, yeah, I was definitely very excited.
So did the show work for you, Normal People? Was it good in your mind?
I haven't actually finished watching it. To be honest with you, selfishly, I watched the episode to see where my song was being placed first. And then I went backwards.
All right.
But yeah, it's definitely been interesting so far. I find the characters very interesting.
Terribly honest of you to say all of that on air. Many people would do that. Let's see where my bit is, and then I'll go back and check the rest out.
Yeah, let's be real.
Yeah. Well, listen, Jay, lovely to speak with you this evening. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. And let's finish up by playing then that track that was used on that song that was used on the soundtrack for Normal People. Oh Lord. Great.
You're telling me, dog, they can't contend with these bars. They hit the pen and get hedged. I hit my pen and recharge. Come at the pen and get lame. I hit my penalties hard. Got in Penelope's head, now I'm in Penelope's yard. Hola, I guess I'll never meet God. I've tried to stay away from them. They've been compelling me hard. I saw Melanie roast the men, now I'm with Melanie Mart. I get to hit with some head, and that's why I'm mentally scarred. Entering my next chapter while I'm vibing out. Got the X factor, tell Simon that my time is now. And tell those other boys, make them 9-9 and all. Damn it, I'm even rhyming when I'm signing out.
There you go. Oh Lord, from JLOL with Aaron Unknown, as used on the series Normal People. And that single that we heard from JLOL, Jules played it at the beginning of the item, released tomorrow, and looking forward enormously to the new album when we get it in December. The Luminaries is a new six-part costume drama set in the South Island of New Zealand during the 1865 Gold Rush. It's based on the Booker Prize-winning novel of the same name, and it stars Irish actor Eve Hewson as the central character Anna Wetherill and Hamish Patel as her love interest Emery Staines. The series is a mixture of adventure story, a parable on greed and a belief in cosmic relations, and where East meets West, a kind of melting pot of hokitika in New Zealand. It begins this Sunday night. Keshi has been watching it for us, and she's with me in studio now. Eleanor Catton's novel, I think so many people said at the time, Kay, of that Booker win, this is unfilmable. The structure is so literary. The narrative shape is so literary. So Eleanor Catton said, well, I can do it.
I'll do it myself, yeah, because it was around 830 pages long. And then the structure was, she structured it like astrology. So the first chapter was really long, and then the chapters descended into very small, kind of, which mapped the pattern of the moon, the phases of the moon. And then she had like 12 characters who come together at the beginning, and they're trying to piece together the story. So you could imagine she was kind of deconstructing, I guess, the 18th century novel. And I suppose that was her aim at that time. So they said it was unfilmable. Then she worked on Emma, the latest Emma by Autumn de Wilde. She wrote the screenplay of that. And then I think it's taken her 7 years. It took her 5 years to write the book. Now it's taken her 7 years to deconstruct it. Now, I think, I'm not too sure, but as far as I could make out, there's a few characters missing. Some characters changed their trajectory a bit. Yeah. This is from the book. And it's kind of towards this, maybe the third and fourth episode. So you start to see these 12 characters who were there at the beginning of the book. So it opens with a very dramatic event. It's the Gold Rush in New Zealand. There's a boat, it seems to be on its side on the sea. There's a young woman running up from the shore. She's wearing a pink dress and a taupe coat, and it's spilling or seeping or bleeding gold dust all over the ground. And she comes up to this shack, and observing her on horseback, two men, and there's this Maori man outside the shack, and somebody shoots him from the shack. She runs into the shack, she comes back out, and she faints. So we have the two men observing what's happening. They're not sure what's happening, but this is the dramatic event that takes, is quite central. But then we go back in time, 18 months in time, we're in a boat, a very calm boat, and we meet two people. The people you mentioned, Emery Staines, played by Hamish Patel, and Anna Wetherill, played by Eve Hewson. And they are coming to New Zealand to find their fortune. And this is when they meet.
Can you believe it? They're proper magic. Incredible good luck. As long as you don't shoot one dead with a crossbow.
What would happen?
If you killed an albatross, well, the wind would drop, the sun would burn hotter and hotter, and then two spirits would rise up from the deep, death and living nightmare. They'd play dice right here on the deck, and whoever won the game would claim your soul.
I don't have a crossbow.
Well, thank heavens, nor do I. Mr. Emery Staines.
Miss Anna Wetherill.
Was this your first sea voyage?
Yes.
Mine too. It wasn't at all what I expected. I always imagined, once we were out at sea, that the horizon would form a circle around the ship, but it wasn't that at all.
It was a square.
Yes, it was a square. It had corners. Astonishing.
That's Anna, played by Eve Hewson, and Emery Staines, played by Hamish Patel in The Luminaries. They plan to meet later, Kay.
Yes, they plan to meet later. So he gives her the name of the hotel he's staying in, not knowing that she's illiterate and can't read what's read or written. She goes into the town, and of course she being innocent, her bag is robbed. The robber runs off with her bag, but it's recovered by this woman, Lydia Wells. Lydia Wells is played by Eva Green. She's draped in green velvet. She's sporting these feathered hats. She's very imposing, and you know she's trouble. So she meets Anna, and they discuss what they're, you know, what she's going to do next.
I don't know. Thank you. Women in this country are outnumbered 12 to 1.
We must stick together. Mrs. Lydia Wells.
Miss Anna Wetherill. I just arrived.
From?
London.
On your own?
Yes, ma'am.
Sent for or sent away?
I sent myself.
When is your birthday? The day you were born, do you know it?
Why do you ask?
I ask everyone I meet.
Actually, it's today.
Is it? Today. Walk with me. So, Miss Anna Wetherell, how will you make your living here at the end of the world?
I thought I'd try digging for gold.
A fine ambition.
But you know, the real money at a gold rush isn't made on the diggings.
It's made in town. I myself operate a fortune parlor. The House of Many Wishes is the name. I open every night at 10 o'clock. Cards before midnight, fortunes in the witching hour. And then, depending on the company, a little traffic with the dead.
And that's Eva Green as Lydia Wells and Eve Hewson as Anna in this Eleanor Catton's own adaptation of her Booker Prize winning novel, The Luminaries. The whole cosmology aspect of things is set up there, Kay.
Yes, because Emery Staines and Anna Wetherill are both born at the same time and the same day. So being an astral twin means that, you know, cosmically you're connected. So later on, even though they don't really meet until much, much later in the series, there are feelings that either, you know, she learns how to read. So he must be feeding her stuff, or she, when he's drowning, she feels as though she's drowning, so that there's this drag across ages between them.
Now, I know you've only seen a couple of, you haven't seen all of the episodes.
I've seen about four of the episodes, and I think it gets better. I think the opening section is very, you know, she's trying to establish all her characters. There's an awful lot of lingering close-ups on Eva Hewson's beautiful face, but you just think, get on with it.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot of nods of, we're doing a deal here, or we're undercutting another character. Whereas it gets to about episode 3, and we're off at the gold, where they're digging for gold. Eve is now a prostitute. She's on drugs, and just it gets more exciting, and there's much more action.
So you're excited to get back to it?
Yes,
but
I definitely watch the end.
Slow to start out. That's The Luminaries. Then, okay, she's speaking to us about that. It starts on Sunday. This Sunday, 9 p.m. on BBC One, and that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy researched, Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator, Gar Duffy was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.